Mr. Parry 1. Can you tell me where you were born and something about your family background, please?
Yes, I was born in Reading, near Reading. Strangely enough, although I don't remember the time, in a place called the Old Kennels at Burfield, near Reading. And for a long time I imagined that I was born in a dog kennel. And that was on the 23rd of November 1919.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was out of work a great deal of the time, but basically he was a carpenter, and he took whatever jobs that came along.
Did you go to school in that area?
I did. I went to primary school in Reading, and eventually won a scholarship to Reading School, which is grant-maintained school.
How old were you when you left?
When I went there, I was 10 years old. And this changed my life quite a bit, in fact, because it was quite an honour. The school had and still has some paying pupils, but the majority of them went in the same as I did for the Berkshire, I think, Reading and the Berkshire area, in open competition at the age of 10, 11.
Did you leave at 16?
Well, one was expected to go on to 18. I did very well at first. But making excuses for myself, things were very difficult at home. And my family couldn't have afforded for me to go to university anyway. And from being a quick starter, if you like, I slowed down considerably and eventually got shoved into a backwater at the school where they let you take matric exam instead of going on to the old higher certificate and university. So I got a school certificate and left the school at the age of 17, 18. Worked for a while with the Thames Valley Traction Company in Reading. Applied to join the Royal Air Force and did so as a trainee observer in June 1939.
Why had you decided to go in for the RAF?
I think as much as anything else, to get away from home.
But you could have joined some other service.
Oh, the RAF in particular. I don't know, really. I don't think I can answer that question. Flying, of course, was considered a bit of an adventure at the time. Maybe I'd had rather a dull life till then, and perhaps the adventure side of the thing appealed to me. I don't know.
Was it easy to get into the RAF?
With the education I had, it was fairly easy. The more difficult part was the physical examination. And I remember great hulking chaps going up and failing for some reason or other. And I was not a particularly well-developed lad. But to my surprise, I got in. I think I have the figure in my head of they accepted 2 out of 5 on medical. And yes, I passed the thing and were very happy to do so.
Did you anticipate in June 1939 that a war was going to break out soon?
I think everybody had this at the back of their minds. Had I been asked the direct question, I think I would have been sufficiently well informed at the time to say that war was probably inevitable. But I would have been dragged into the forces anyway. And I looked upon it, you know, one's parents had been involved in the previous war, and to us it was a sort of thing that came along at every generation. It was our turn now.
So what was your reaction when war was declared in September?
Heightened excitement. I think nothing more than that.
So no sense of dismay?
Oh, no. No, I probably didn't think the thing through, and I could have been dismayed that a lot of people were going to die and suffer in other ways. But I don't think I thought about that a great deal.
What did you think of the kind of training that you received in 39-40?
Well, in looking back on it, I suppose it was not very thorough, although probably as thorough as anybody's at the time. It was just over a 3-month course to learn air navigation. And it was a fairly elementary sort of navigation. We never got as far as astro-navigation and things like that. And of course, radar was not used at the time. So it was a question of learning to map read and doing accurate dead reckoning navigation.
Were you happy to be a navigator, or had you had ambitions to be a pilot or something?
No, in fact, the board that I saw asked me, did I want to be a pilot? And I said, no, I wanted to be an observer. I think this was because I felt quite happy to be deciding where the aircraft was going. The pilot to me was a driver. He was also, incidentally, always captain of the aircraft in those days, regardless of ranks. But that part of things didn't worry me. No, I thought that navigating and bombing aiming was more interesting than flying an aircraft at the time. This was a bad decision, if the decision had been mine, because, of course, until shortly before I left the Air Force, some 20 years later, you were much more assured of a career in the Air Force if you were a pilot than if you were a navigator. In fact, until it was many years later before a navigator ever commanded a squadron. It had just started when I left the Air Force, only one or two.
So how long was it before you regretted the idea of applying to be an observer?
I don't think I ever did regret it. I was not particularly ambitious to achieve very high rank. I was very ambitious to do my job well, but I didn't link that to promotion particularly.
How keen were you to get onto an operational squadron in 39-40?
Oh, I was quite happy to do that. I knew it had to come, and I felt I wanted to play my part as best I could.
Which was the first operational squadron you did get to, in fact?
If I could answer with a little bit of history at the time, having finished my navigation training, and the war started during that period. We were at Anstey near Coventry, and when the war broke out on the 3rd of September, I remember we were sent out to guard the aircraft, and I spent the night sitting on the wheel of a Tiger Moth, armed with a pickaxe handle, waiting for German paratroops to come over the hedge with all sorts of modern arms. And as everybody knows, there was an air raid warning, a false warning, on that very first night. Anyway, I was then sent to do the rest of my training, bombing and gunnery, at Penrhos in North Wales. We lost some time. We got mixed up. There's a lot of confusion, of course, at the time, with volunteer reserve air crew, and I found myself doing drill and square bashing down at Hastings for, I don't know, I can tell from the logbook, but it doesn't matter. Certainly 6 weeks or so, which I found a great waste of time. And then I did a further period as a bombing instructor at Hallavington, instructing pilots in bombing and gunnery. And that was quite interesting. I had been since my first days in the Air Force with another observer called Jimmy Parvin. Now, our names, Parvin, are together, so our numbers were together. I was 581118, and he was 581119. We had been inseparable friends. And we were wandering off from Hallavington for a walk one sunny day in May 1940, and an RAF policeman caught us up on a cycle, said we were to go back to the guard room, and found that we were posted to advance air striking force in France. And we left the next day, flew out from Gatwick, which was then just a field bounded by the racecourse. And we got to a maintenance unit at Glissy near Amiens. The retreat was already in full swing, and confusion reigned. There were one or two little interesting episodes during those few days. Well, I don't know whether you'd like to hear about
Please,
those.
Please, in detail, if you could.
Incident one. A formation of, I think, 39 Heinkel 111Ks came over to bomb Amiens, obviously. In 13 VIX of 3, they were flying in VIX of 3 in line astern. There were very few air crew on this. Well, of course, there was no squadron base there. It was just a place for repairing airplanes. But there were three Lysanders on the airfield, and three pilots clambered into these things with volunteer gunners to try and do something about these chaps overhead. And all three were shot down by the top cover. I think 110s came down and shot them before they got anywhere, virtually. There was also a young pilot, appropriately named Pilot Officer Bird. Why I should remember this, I don't know. And he decided to have a go, clambered into a Hurricane. And he got over the top of these people, and he sorted one out. We all cheered loudly. And he chased him down to the ground, came in and landed. We tried to refuel him and failed because there were no self-sealing tanks in the Hurricane in those days. And the fuel came out as fast as we put it in. But I thought that was marvellous because this chap had not done any... he just got his wings, you know. He was not operationally trained at all. So he did jolly well. I don't know what happened to him.
So he shot down what?
One Heinkel.
And this was over Gliese?
Yes. Yeah.
But you didn't go up yourself?
No. No, I didn't. I was still with Jimmy Parvin. By then, I don't think there were any pilots left on the place. Anyway, the squadron leader in charge, there obviously was no communication, but somebody arrived on a motorcycle and said it was about time we cleared off, which was fairly evident. There was a lot of gunfire going on up the road. For a couple of days, British and French troops had been going by in trucks, and I happened to speak French because my mother's French. There was a troop of French cavalry came by and said, "What the hell are you doing there? You know, you shouldn't be hanging around here. You should be off."
You mean cavalry on horses?
Yes. What they were going to do, I don't know, but there they were. Anyway, squad leader pulled us together and said, "Right, we're going to try and get out of here. Don't take anything more than you can walk with." Refugees were coming along the road. These pitiful lines of poor people with mattresses and things stacked with on horse and cart and perambulators, the things we've all read about. So we prepared to leave, and some made a dash for the Naffy store and loaded themselves up with whiskey. They didn't keep that for very long. We set fire to the aircraft that were left as far as possible. Somebody foolishly lit the fuel dump so that everybody knew we were going. All this was watched by a couple of ME-110s who were circling overhead. And we had some transport, which we clambered aboard a truck, and as soon as we started to move, the 110s came down and started to strafe us and the poor refugees on the road. So we leapt into the nearest ditch until that had passed. We had a Mercury engine on board, which we levered off. We thought that was a waste of space and couldn't go any faster. And through the night, we got to Boulogne. On the way, we went through the village where I'd spent a lot of my holidays as a youth. My uncle, my mother's brother-in-law, was the local tax man there. And we went in front of the very house, which I knew. Arrived at Boulogne, desperately tired. We hadn't slept for some time. By then, odd bits of kit were missing. We were a pretty bedraggled lot, and there was an air raid going on in Boulogne. And I think most of us just fell asleep on the quayside until something else would happen. And we left on what I think was the last ship that got out of Boulogne, the Mona's Queen, which had been on the, I think it was on the Iverman or the Irish ferry before the war. And she got us to Dover. And I believe that she was sunk on the way back to try and pick up some other people. At Dover, all the air crew were ushered into a large hangar and counted in and given a Mars bar and an apple. And we emerged at the other end of this shed up onto the railway platform with a platform on either side where an RAF corporal decided our futures. He directed some people to the left, some to the right. I went to the left and within a few weeks was operating on Blenheims. Those that went to the right finished up on a Wellington OTU and got a proper operational training. It was some months before they started operating. was a bit hazy from then on, but we went to an army camp and got some socks, and I finished up at the RAF depot at Uxbridge, still with Jimmy Parvin.
Just before we take it any further, what squadron was based at Gleeson?
No squadron. It was a maintenance unit. Aircraft went in there for repair and major inspections.
And whereabouts is Gleeson exactly?
Well, in relation to Amiens, it was about 4 or 5 miles out of Amiens, which direction I can't remember. I think south, but I couldn't be at all sure.
So it sounds as though you were in France just a few days.
Oh, yeah, indeed, that was so.
2 days or 3 days?
Probably 5 days.
What was the morale like when you arrived at Gleeson?
People just accepted these things. We were all young and rather foolish. Obviously, we were probably afraid, I suppose. We didn't want to get captured or at this stage of the war. We were jolly glad to get out, I can tell you that. Because one was quite helpless.
How were you handled once you got to Uxbridge?
At Uxbridge, we went on a parade. It was a church parade, which I missed. And we were eventually posted to 18 Squadron, which was reforming at Gatwick, Blenheim Fours. This was after... Perhaps I refer to my logbook on this. I can probably give you a date on that.
So it was June 1940 you found?
I joined 18 Squadron at Gatwick. Now, 18 Squadron had been an advance air striking force in France and had suffered very badly. There were only a few, I don't know how many aircraft left, or crews, but very few. As far as I remember, we had no aircraft actually at Gatwick. I couldn't be sure of this. But we were divided between pilots, observers and gunners. Or more correctly, gunner wireless operators, because the third member of the crew was a gunner wireless operator. The observer was still referred to as an observer those days, but he was in fact a navigator bomb aimer. And I found myself with some new observers and one of the survivors from France, who was the navigation leader, a chap called Joe Strong, Sergeant Joe Strong. And he asked for our experience. Mine was just basic training on Anson aircraft and gunnery in Hawker Demons, bombing on Fairy Battle. As regards night flying, I'd only flown once at night. That was just a ride around for an hour in an Anson. But that was sufficient to make me operational day and night on Blenheim aircraft, although I'd never seen one at that stage. We then, in July, went up to West Raynham, which was to be our base. And we shared it with... was it 139 Squadron? I have to check on that. And on the... I'll refer to my logbook again here. On the 1st of August, we went on our first operation. It was a daylight, single sortie. I'd been teamed up with the captain, Flying Officer Douch, and the gunner was Sergeant Bassett. The operation was to a fighter airfield at Evere. And the conditions in those days were that on single daylight sorties, you were supposed to have 8/10 cloud cover to get to the target. Well, we found ourselves in blue sky, and in any case, we were recalled to base. So we're only out 35 minutes. The first operation finished in as a failure. The next day, we were given another target, which was Wensendorf, southeast of Hamburg, at the limit of Blenheim Range, another fighter airfield. And this time we got much further, and I had very foolishly planned to fly down the river to Wensendorf to make sure of finding it. And again, the cloud gave out. We were in bright sunshine. And Flying Officer Dauch very wisely decided to turn back and attack the secondary target, which was another fighter airfield at Leeuwarden in Holland. Now, I didn't... lack of training there, again, showed. I did a dummy run at 1,000 feet over an occupied fighter airfield because I wanted to see where we were going to put our bombs. That was foolish, of course, but by the time we came round again, they were all taking off in all sorts of directions after us. But there was a bunch of them in a corner of the airfield, which we carefully attacked from about 800 feet, and we put our bombs on it.
With what effect, do you think?
It was... rarely could we see the effect, because for this low-level bombing, we had 11-second delay on the bombs. So it was not often that we saw them actually explode. But from that sort of height, you really can't miss. I don't think I even used the bomb sight. And it was then that, as we were approaching to bomb, the gunner in the back said, and this is hard to believe, but I remember these words very well. He says, "Excuse me, sir," he said, "there are three Messerschmitts behind us. Shall I shoot them down?" Upon which John Dauch, who was a rather donnish sort of chap, said, "Would you please keep quiet, Bassett? We're trying to bomb." So the story that I mentioned in the car earlier can't really be verified from that, since we can't find Bassett anymore. Whether he shot at these people or not, I don't know. They did not hit us, because, or at least they didn't do us any damage, because fortunately a cloud came up over Texel and we shot into that with full boost on and hightailed it for home.
But I think we should say that you were telling me earlier off the record that you've heard since about a possible success in shooting a plane down.
Only possible, because on my own research I found that there was at least one other Blenheim in that area on that day.
We need to say who was shot down.
Oh, so I beg your pardon. Yeah, the chap that shot down was the CO of the squadron.